Okay. The homework was, well, it was a bit of a struggle for some of you. Others got it. The one which had two pairs that had exactly two offspring, I've marked where I think various of you went wrong. A lot of you, those who went wrong, often assume that if I are going to draw two different individuals, and the question is, what's the probability that they are sibs? They said, well, it's 1 over n. And it isn't, because you draw the first one, it's a sampling without replacement, and then there are n minus 1 ones left, one of which is the other sib, so it's 1 over n minus 1. Anyway, that was a common problem. Some of you didn't know how to compare it to the effective population size formulas, but many got it right. The result is that the way it comes out, the effective population size is basically twice the population size. It's because there's less variation from individual to individual in there's less variation than there is in the ordinary Wright-Fisher model. So because there's less variation, there's actually less genetic drift. The effective population size is twice as large as the census size in this case. It's actually 2n minus 3 halves, but roughly twice as large. That's because of the genetic drift you see, some comes from random Mendelian segregation, and some comes from the random births and deaths of individuals, and this has suppressed part of the latter. Okay. The other one was, as I call, more straightforward. Oh, yeah, the simulation. And the simulation, you did a lot of work. There were a total of 48,600 populations simulated over the whole class. Here are the frequencies of fixation for the recessive case, and here it is for the multiplicative case, much larger. Here is, in this case, it's not quite doubled, I thought that sounded felt wrong. No, it's that I recorded it wrong. It's 15 times higher, because the effect, when something has an effect, when there is selection for the heterozygote, that's very visible right away, because all the early, when the gene is at low frequency, it'll occur mostly in heterozygotes and it'll get selected. The recessive one doesn't get selected until it runs into another copy of itself, and so it has much less selection going on. If you compare the formulas that are based on diffusion approximations in the text with these values, it looks like a good fit. It actually isn't quite so good. I did a chi-square test, and this number is actually significantly less than that. The approximation is being a little optimistic about probability of fixation. But anyway, roughly there's a pretty good fit between the simulated fixation probabilities and the approximations formula that are in the notes. Okay. So one last thing about the last homework. Although I said it was due today, take a couple extra days if you need. I realize the end of the quarter is crazy time for everybody. It is crazy enough time for me that I won't get to grading it in the next 2 days. So feel free to turn it in, say Friday, whenever. But not much later than that, because I do have to grade it. Any other questions concerning previous stuff, homeworks, other than the material that we're heading on to now? So in the last couple of lectures, what I'm going to do is to talk about quantitative genetics, which does not simply mean genetics done with numbers. That's what the whole course is about. But the genetics of characters that are measured, that we assess quantitatively. We might measure the length of my forearm, for example, and get a number as to how many centimeters it was, and we can measure that on everybody. And we can look at the distribution of that and look at covariation between relatives and look at issues of what happens if we do artificial selection on it, please.
So this is a silly question maybe, but we don't have fossil Friday, or we have fossil Friday?
We do have class on Friday.
We do have fossil Friday.
Yeah, was there some holiday I didn't know about?
No, there isn't. The last homework was due today, technically, so I didn't know it.
It was due today because we were always turning them in on Wednesdays.
Okay, there is.
But in this case, since I get a sense, I get a sense from my schedule that things are under pressure, and maybe that's true for you, and
okay.
I'll give you a little more flexibility. It won't hurt my grading process. I was terrified that you'd come up with some holiday
I didn't know about.
Okay.
I was like, it's awesome Friday, but then I just had like a second thought there's not.
Or maybe it's going to, and it might snow. I don't know. So for quantitative genetics, it turns out that there is a theory that was developed. And it was developed in 1918 in one great paper by R.A. Fisher, and I haven't talked too much about R.A. Fisher, and I'm not going to say that much. But let's first talk about two other people who tried to do a theory of the inheritance of quantitative characters before Mendelian genetics was really known. And they are Francis Galton and Carl Pearson, who worked together. Pearson was more or less a follower of Galton's. They were at University College London, in the relevant period, late 1800s. Galton was a younger cousin of Charles Darwin's. Galton was very interested in application of numbers to all sorts of things, and he was very interested in, among other things, eugenics. In fact, he coined the term eugenics. He's the one who coined that term. He and Pearson used to go around measuring people. One of the things they used to do was have a storefront in London. And if you wandered by the storefront, they would come charging out and talk you back into the storefront and measure your head, measure your height. And they had great log books of these measurements. By today's standards, that's a ridiculous way of sampling. But the library at the University College London has stacks of their old ledger books with this useless data. But nevertheless, they in the process invented quite a few statistical terms that we use today. For example, they plotted offspring against parents, and they needed a coefficient for the slope. And they felt it was a slope of something they called regression. So the word regression comes from their work. Number of statistical procedures in multivariate statistics really flow out of the work of Galton and Pearson. They had, from 1889 on, something called the law of ancestral heredity, which is basically a regression formula, which they felt was somehow fundamental, biologically fundamental. But they didn't understand anything about the actual inheritance of continuous characters, because there was no Mendelian genetics until the year 1900, when it was rediscovered. They have come to be called the biometricians. Their field, their approach to their field, is the biometricians. When Mendelism came along, they opposed it. They felt that didn't really apply to their characters. In the early 1900s, after the rediscovery of Mendel, a number of people working, some of them associated with Galton and Pearson, some work even done by Galton and Pearson, but particularly work by this guy, R.A. Fisher, explained the variation of continuous characters successfully in Mendelian terms. And I'll be showing you Fisher's scheme in a moment. R.A. Fisher published a paper in 1918 in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. And it is a brilliant paper that is utterly impossible to read. People throw whole seminars of people at this paper, going through it line by line, and they fail. It's partly because Fisher was very nearsighted, and being very nearsighted, he tended not to work on paper. He did it all in his head. So when Fisher says, well, obviously, then you know you're in for a day of difficult algebra. And the thing about Fisher is he's famous among statisticians because he virtually invented modern mathematical statistics. He's responsible for about, I'd say, about half of its important concepts. He's responsible for the concepts of consistency, sufficiency, and efficiency. He's responsible for maximum likelihood, the likelihood ratio test, theorems on the good statistical behavior of likelihood. He's responsible for the distribution of the correlation coefficient. He's the one who figured out that in a 2x2 chi-square, you should test with 1 degree of freedom and not 3. Thereby earning himself the enmity of Carl Pearson, who had said 3. And he just has this huge impact on mathematical statistics. Many statisticians then say, well, I hear he also did something on genetics. But what he did on genetics was found quantitative genetics with this paper. And in addition, he published a book, The Genetical Theory of Natural Selection, in 1930 that discussed, mostly verbally, how genetics could get together with natural selection. And Fisher, together with Sewell Wright, are the two great figures of theoretical population genetics. It's generally held that their contribution exceeds that of the third the third member of that trinity, J.B.S. Haldane. Fisher was also, could be a very difficult person. If you admired him enough and respected him enough, he liked you, but if you contradicted anything he said, you went onto his bad list, and then you were in for a lot of trouble. He was not a very charming person from everything I've heard. I never saw them. I missed him by one day. I was an undergraduate in Jim Crow's lab in Madison in 1962 or so. And Fisher came through one day to, his daughter lived in Madison. He came through Madison, he went to Jim Crow's lab, he met everybody. That day I didn't come into the lab. So the next few days later, everybody had photographs of themselves with Fisher, so I never saw him. Okay, so what did Fisher do? Well, we'll get to his model in a second. But first thing I want to show you is give you some feel, some examples to give you some feel for when we think this way in these quantitative genetic terms and when we think Mendelianly. Here is a one locus character. Imaginary one I made that has three phenotypes that correspond to three genotypes with two allele character. make things more interesting, I made these things have log normal distributions, and there's some Hardy-Weinberg proportions. But you can look at it and you can say, well, if we were analyzing this, we would figure out that all the 2s, the 4s, and the 5s represented 3 different genotypes. And we could more or less ignore exactly what the value was of individuals beyond that, and we could do some successful Mendelian analysis of this character. If you fatten those distributions, if you allow the non-genetic variation, environmental variation, to be bigger, you might fatten them just enough that those two merged with each other, and then it looks like a single peak. It isn't really, it's a mixture of two somewhat widened peaks. But you can at least see the difference between two of the genotypes, between this genotype and the other two. Fatten it a bit further and you suddenly find out that this thing looks like a continuous distribution, and you don't really have any hope, at least an easy hope, of making a one-locus Mendelian analysis, the analysis of this without a lot of curve fitting. So you start to enter a realm where you're going to have to describe the characters its distribution, its means, its variances, and so on, and think about those. Here's another case with a two-locus quantitative character with a whole bunch of genotypes. And again, you fatten them, and now it looks like there are three bumps. You might look at that and say, oh, yeah, there's one locus, but there isn't actually. There are two loci, and then if you fatten them more, once again, you get a continuous distribution. So as the background noise, the environmental noise, starts to contribute more to the character, you lose the ability to see different genotypes in a simple way. Here is something to give you an example that will give you an idea of the special role that the normal distribution plays in all of this. Here, what I've done is take a trait with one locus, that's what the little n is. There's dominance, so there's two different phenotypes. They form peaks in a distribution. The background variation is just the environmental variation is just large enough to have them start to merge. What I've done is I've scaled it so that the overall genetic variance is the same in these cases. And the environmental effect always contributes 20% of the variation. So that's true for this one locus one. Well, suppose you had a trait where instead of one locus of large effect, you had two loci. I'm giving them all the same gene frequency, but they would be at linkage equilibrium. They'd be distributed independently in the population. And each locus would have a smaller effect, so you still get 70% or 80% of the variation genetic. Coming from these two loci, now you'll get a distribution that looks like that. What I did is make each locus have the same gene frequency, and I made them have the same effects of the different genotypes. When you go up to five loci, you find that basically now you have a continuous distribution. It's a little bit bumpy and humpy and bumpy. Not quite a normal distribution, although if you had that data and you had a finite sample, you might not be able to tell that from a normal. When you go up to 10, it really looks like a normal distribution. So you can see that as you get more and more genotypes contributing to the genetic variation, that in this case they're adding up in their effects on the scale, that the distributions start to look very normal. Even though underlying it, there are these individual loci that have two possible contributions that they make. And so they're individually not anything like normal. But I think people who work with statistics know that when you add up random variables, there are, of course, good central limit theorems that tell you that the asymptotically you start to get to everything being normally distributed, except in weird cases. Okay, so now let's go. Oh yeah, that's going. Yeah, here's one. This is another one with the two locus case. It's more or less what I showed you before. I think I'm going to skip over it. Okay, I'm going to get to Fisher's model. What did R.A. Fisher do in 1918? Well, what he said was, let us imagine a trait that has a scale, it has some genes that are contributing to the trait, and it has some environmental variation. And what Fisher said was, well, let's imagine that the genes, the different loci, act additively. That is, each one adds or subtracts something to the trait. And this happens independently at each locus. And we'll be getting into the detailed assumptions in a moment. What one thing that's going to be assumed is Hardy-Weinberg proportions. You're in a random mating population. Another thing that will be assumed is linkage equilibrium. The individual loci, their presence and absence of the different alleles are independent. And an environmental effect is getting added to the trait. So the trait starts out with some arbitrary starting point, sometimes taken to be the population mean, but not always. In this case, it's the number 4. And then here is a scheme for what the different genotypes do at the A locus. Here it is at the B locus. Here it is at the C locus. And I've just kind of filled in values. Some of them show dominance. Some of them show big effects. Some of them show much smaller effects. There are gene frequencies at each locus. They don't have to be equal. So any particular genotype, you can figure out what the contribution to the trait will be by working your way through the table, taking the particular choice, and then adding on an environmental effect, which is going to be assumed to be drawn from a distribution with a mean of zero. So a normal, in this case, a normal distribution, and independently of all that. Now, right away, I should say that real loci interact with each other in interesting ways, sometimes strongly and often not. But here we're approximating that by simply assuming that the process is additive. And Fischer will get out of that a big payoff. But the question will come up later, is interaction between the loci going to mess this up? And the answer is, unless it's very strong, less than you might think. So here we can imagine a genotype. There are some chromosomes drawn and with A's, B's, C's, and D's. And we can take different, we can work our way along these genes and refer to the table. So at the E locus, you're a heterozygote and you're going to add on a 0.3. Here's the starting point, 4. So we've got 4 plus 0.3. And we work our way down. Here's the genotype that we're, this is this genotype. Then we subtract 2 for the A locus, that's this genotype here. Add 6 for the C at the C locus, add 0.7 at the D locus, add 0.1 at the B locus. Now these are all the genetic contributions, and now we have to draw something from the environmental distribution, and let's say it turned out to be 0.9. The result is, in this case, we get a phenotype of 10. It's a little too convenient that it comes out as a whole number. It's not supposed to. And we can do that for every genotype. We can imagine ourselves going through, and with every genotype, looking at the genetic effects, adding an independent environmental effect, and doing that, and getting phenotypes for each of the genotypes. So we could imagine a character working like this. Our problem will be that we don't know the scheme. We don't know how many loci are contributing, and we don't actually see these genotypes, and we don't know what these tables are. So you might say, well, what good is that? I mean, if you don't know any of that, you're just not going to be able to do anything. Not so. You can do some things. And here we get into Fischer's scheme, Fischer's method of coming up with some numerical effects and then showing what rules they would lead to about variances and covariances. And it's really, in a sense, one of the great intellectual achievements. What Fischer does, now this is going to sound crazy. He says, well, let's imagine one of those loci. Again, we don't know this locus really, but suppose it were actually true that we had two alleles, A1 and A2, and if you're A1, A1, then you've got two copies of A1. So these three hash marks here correspond, equally spaced, correspond to the three genotypes, one homozygote, the other homozygote, heterozygote right in between. Now Fischer says, okay, supposing that somebody told you what the contribution that this locus would make to the phenotype, and that it was this value for this genotype, this value for the other, those are not quite equal. So it's this locus, in the way I've drawn it, is almost dominant. The A1 allele is almost dominant, but not quite. And here it is for the A2 genotype. Now Fischer says, imagine, let us do something that appears to be a waste of time. Let us consider those three points, consider the frequencies of these three genotypes in the population. Those will be some sort of Hardy-Weinberg proportions. And let's fit a straight line to those points by least squares, weighting the points by their Hardy-Weinberg frequencies. So we're going to try to minimize the sum of squares around the line, but where the contribution from each genotype is the square of the difference here times the frequency of that genotype. So we're going to have a least squares fit of this line. Now you might say, well, why are we fitting the line? When we fit the line, we are assigning fictional additive effects to these alleles. That is, the fit here predicts this genotype, does not do it perfectly. The purple prediction says that for if you have that genotype, you get an effect alpha for the first copy of A1 and another effect alpha 1 for the second copy of A1. For the other homozygote, you have an effect alpha 2. These are called additive effects. These would happen to be negative. And there's an effect from each of the copies of the gene, and it makes a prediction, which, however, is not exactly correct. And in the heterozygote, you have the positive effect of an alpha 1 and the negative effect for the other allele, alpha 2. Those predictions are perfectly additive. They're in a straight line. The remaining effect that you have to assume is the departure from the line, and we're calling that delta 1-1, delta 1-2, and delta 2-2. Those are called dominance deviations. Okay, so we have additive effects and dominance deviations. Again, these are not things that in a quantitative genetic study you actually see, because you don't know about the gene. It's in there somewhere. There are many genes, and they're in there somewhere. But Fisher first imagines that you could come up with these effects if you knew everything. Okay. And he imagines that you establish them by this regression fitting. There's a somewhat more extensive discussion of this in chapter 9 of the book. So the assumptions he's making are the ones I've mentioned. Random mating, so there's Hardy-Weinberg proportions. Linkage equilibrium. The environmental effects are drawn from a distribution and they're independent of the genotype. So it's not true that, say, some genotypes are more buffered against the environment than others and less affected by the environment than others. In different individuals, we're going to assume that the environmental effects are independent. That's a big and probably not so good assumption, because individuals that, say, live near each other are likely to experience similar environments, and so there'll be some correlations that don't reflect this. And we're assuming no interaction between the loci. The phenotype just is a sum of contributions from the different loci. Okay. The result of all those assumptions, imagining we did it at every locus and assigned alphas and deltas, is that when we pick a random individual, the alphas from any locus will be independent of each other because they reflect the two alleles, which by Hardy-Weinberg are independent of each other. Within a locus, now this is a little tricky, the alphas and the delta that are contributed in that individual at this locus are uncorrelated. Notice I'm saying uncorrelated, not they're not technically independent, but they are uncorrelated. The least squares fit guarantees that. And that's, he did it knowingly to get that. At different loci, by linkage equilibrium, the alpha contributions and delta contributions at one locus are independent of those at another locus because the genotypes are independent. Okay. By linkage equilibrium, and the environmental effect is independent. So the result of all of this is that Fisher has assigned starting point plus an effect of the first copy at the first locus, an effect of the second copy at the first locus, and a dominance deviation of their interaction. And he's done that at every locus. So we've got an alpha, alpha, delta, alpha, alpha, delta, blah, 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 and finally an environmental effect. Epsilon, being added on. So you've made, whoops, I'm sorry. So you've made a fictional assignment of effects to individual copies and to pairs of copies at a locus. You have no assignment of effects to other interactions. You have an assignment of an effect to an environmental effect. Again, I re-emphasize, I've been hammering away at this. All of this is conceptual. It's not something you can do in real life, generally speaking, unless you were to go in and sequence the DNA. Okay, now what do you do with it? Well, you say, okay, we can. The other thing we can do, and this is completely trivial, is you can take that sum and rearrange the terms. You can put all the alphas together and all the deltas together, and then you can say, and actually I shouldn't have any dots here because there's no, what I should do is put this parenthesis here should go right after the dots. That's what really should happen. That's an inner. So what you've fictionally done is break up the observed phenotype into a starting point plus an additive effect, which is the sum of all these individual gene fictional effects, plus a dominance deviation, which is the sum of all those deltas, plus an environmental effect, which is actually the capital E is actually the same as this little epsilon. Now, having done it that way, it has the interesting property that these pieces are not correlated with each other. Again, they're not quite independent, but they're uncorrelated. First of all, the first one doesn't vary at all. Then there's some variation due to the alpha effect, some variation due to deltas, and some variation due to environments. Those are uncorrelated contributions. When you have uncorrelated random effects adding up, it follows by a few lines of algebra that the variances of the total are just the sum of the variances of these pieces. Being uncorrelated, there are no covariance terms from pairs of them. It's just the variances add up. So now we have fictionally taken the variance of the trait, which is something that we can observe. You can go make a histogram, get the variance. You can get a number for that from a sample from the population. And you can say, well, we imagine that that is coming from additive variance, dominance variance, and environmental variance under this model. Now, here is the tricky part. We want to also look at covariation of relatives. To what extent are, say, full siblings correlated in their phenotype? And for that, we need covariances. Now, I'm not telling you much about covariances. And when people study statistics, they often don't really learn about them. They learn about correlations, and they like to use the word correlation. What covariance is, I guess I should have made a figure for it here, is that if you have two variables and they're distributed, called x and y, and they're distributed in some sort of scattergram here, there's a quantity that you can measure called the covariance. This is getting difficult here. Which is the average, for a sample, it's the average. For a distribution, theoretical distribution, it's the expectation of a product of two quantities. One is how far x is above its mean, so mean of x, and how far y is above its mean. And the product of those two, it's actually the area of a little rectangle, if you average it over the sample, if the points are distributed like this, there'll be more positive contributions from positive number times a positive number or a negative number times a negative number than there are negative contributions, and you'll get out a positive number. And that thing is called the covariance. And we're going to assume that we're going to look at some covariances of relatives. But first we have to